and welcome to today's segment of Afternoon Satsang, where we will be continuing with the book Conversations with Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba, written by Dr. John Hislop, based on his interactions, interviews and conversations with Swami. This episode that we will be going through today is quite a fast-moving one, because a lot of questions have been asked, very interesting questions, if I may say so, and Swami gives very, very interesting and insightful answers. I say interesting because if we were to imagine Swami answering some of these questions, we might assume that he would have answered in this manner or stuck to these points or something like that. But some of the answers that Swami gives totally takes us by surprise, and it's very, very beautiful and enjoyable in that sense. Just to update all of you quickly, even as we go through these conversations, the whole of Prashanthi Nilayam is gearing up for the annual sports and cultural meet. The students from all the campuses, Vrindavan, Anantapur, Mudinhalli, Prashanthi Nilayam, of course, the schools, the Ishwaramma Primary School, everybody, they're all practicing very hard to put up a grand show, which, of course, you can catch all the action live on Radio Sai on the 11th of January. So, in that energy, the energy of sports meet, we will begin today. And before we go dive deep into it, we would like to offer our humble pranams at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan. And I would like to invite Brother Prem to give us a quick summary of last week's, and then we can proceed. Sairam Prem.
Sairam Arvind, and Sairam to all our listeners. It's a beautiful Thursday, and as we said, today's episode is going to be quite interesting in the sense of there is not much of explanation from our end, and if that's going to be interesting to you, and this episode is going to be one. The last week, there were a couple of things that we discussed. Mainly, one of the topics which was being repeatedly asked about was something which Hislop referred to as divine vision. I think that's how it all started. Swami had spoken about it even in the episode that we did before that, and Hislop asked a question again regarding that. And pretty much what Swami says is, when you're able to look beyond the name and form, you're able to see the divinity in that person, and that is what we refer to as a divine vision. But interestingly, he somewhere asked this question about different scenarios where you look at God in the person. He asked about looking at it in wild animals. Do wild animals become docile when you're able to look at the God within them? He asked a few questions based on that. He asked a question, should we look at your wife as God? Mm-hmm. Right? And Swami said that if you look at your wife as God, she will sit on your head. I think that was a very interesting thing, because one of the ways Swami uses that word wife, the inner meaning with which Swami uses is, Swami uses it for mind. I think even in a conversation with Mr. Mussolini, I think, right? The one who wrote The Catholic Priest.
Don Mario Mussolini.
Yeah, Don Mario. He says that. Swami comes and asks him a couple of times, mm-hmm. where's your wife or how is your wife?
Oh, and he's a celibate.
He's a sworn celibate priest. So he's pretty confounded by Swami repeatedly asking him this. And then somebody tells him that when Swami refers to wife, it means the mind. And then when he, goes back and looks at all the conversations which Swami had been asking about it, it clearly was an indication of, how's your mind? Is it peaceful? Are you taking care of it? Is it under control? Mm. Right. So when Swami says here, if you look at, it's a very cryptic way Swami puts it. He says, if you look at your wife as God, she will sit on your head. But you should see that wife, I don't have the exact statement, where Swami says that, but you should understand that God is within and shines through her too. And that's almost a definition of what Swami gives of the mind.
The mind is the child of the Atma, and right. Atma shines through the mind.
Exactly. The mind should not be taken as the master. You should give it its place. But at the same time, you should look at it as a reflection of God too. So that was, so many scenarios where, how do you look at God? And Swami was telling about when there is a very difficult person you deal with. Swami said, even in that person, you can see that God is there within, and you will find the situation changes when you do that. Mm. And then Swami said, sometimes it will not, which means that person is meant to be there in your life and put you through what you're supposed to go through.
For some karmic reason.
Right, for some karmic reason. I think those were the points which we went through, and the question that we're going to start off with today is, quite different from whatever has been spoken so far.
Yes, Hislop says, I bought this book, The Saints of India. Swami opens the book and starts looking at the names. And then Swami says, they are not saints. They were scholars and heads of religious sects. And then Swami read through the list, making a comment in Telugu about each name. The translator keeps silent at this point in time. So Hislop doesn't understand what Swami is saying. But at the end of it, Hislop says, Swami, it would be good to know the names of some real saints so that I could read them. Swami says, what is meant by saint? Hislop replies, I mean a messenger from God. From the list of 10 names, the world thinks of Shankara, Ramakrishna and Ramana Maharshi as being such. You know, this is something that all of us can empathize with. At least I can definitely empathize, because I remember as a student in Swami's school, when we joined, I was in full josh and energy and I wanted to, you know, utilize the time spent as a student in the most perfect manner possible. In fact, today also when I look back, I think I was a better devotee and a more sincere student when I joined than many years after that, because familiarity, though it may not breed contempt, it sometimes breeds neglect at least. So, in that josh, you know, began to read through some Vahinis and read through Satya Sai Speaks. And though I would not admit it then, today with maturity, I think I can admit and say that I used to get bored and I used to feel, oh God, what is this? At the same time, somebody handed me a book called The Autobiography of a Yogi, written by Paramahamsa Yogananda. I found it riveting, gripping. And in my heart, I just hoped that, Swami, I hope that this is a very, very good literature and it is a ideal book, because I love reading it. It's wonderful when what is good for you and what is pleasant come together. Usually we see what is good is not pleasant and what is pleasant is not good. And this happens, I feel, because to appreciate the words of God in their pristine purity, Swami gives us the distillate. To be able to enjoy it, appreciate it without getting bored, we need to rise up to a certain level possibly. That is why we often, you know, find it easy to look at the lives of people who are like us, possibly a few notches higher, so that we can aspire to be at that level. But while that is good to take as an inspiration, it is not the ideal case scenario, because the highest is available to us. Swami has made it available to us. Just because we are lazy or we don't have that attitude, to seek the second best or third best would not be an ideal case scenario. But I can definitely empathize with anybody who wishes that, Swami, which are the lives of saints or stories that we can read? Because in the spiritual field, stories and experiences are always easier to read than message and teachings. And that is what it is, you know, even now, Prem, when we have a satsang on, they came, they saw and they got conquered. It's the stories of different people who came to disprove Swami and who became devotees. People say, wow, it was riveting, it was exciting. But we also get feedback when we do conversations with Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba is, oh, that part is boring, why don't you, you know, bring in more energy and something more nice. That is because basically we are looking at satsang also as a way to entertain our mind. Like you said, you know, this is what Swami is saying, you don't allow, you know, the wife, mind, because mind is such an important thing. Swami says, manayeva manusharanam karanam bandha mokshayo. It can lead you to liberation, it can get you stuck in bondage. So, in satsang, it is so important that we try to immerse ourselves and bring our entire heart into it. Though there will be a component of the mind, if the mind component dominates, I think even in a satsang, we'll start looking out more for the entertainment value and enjoyment value rather than the spiritual uplift that it can give to us.
Absolutely. I think there are two distinct phases in that sense. One is when you also look for something interesting so that the mind does not stray away from the good things, right? One of the best examples you can think of for that is bhajans, where initially a lot of devotees get attracted to Swami's fold through bhajans because it's something interesting, it is involving, music is always enjoyable. At the same time, you are doing something which is holy and sacred. But Swami will say after a certain point, it becomes like medicine, whether you like it or not. It is a regimen, it is a, you know, padyam, Patyam. Aushadam and Patyam. So I mean, after some time, it becomes like a regulation that is good for your life. So you take it whether or not your mind enjoys it. Talking about sayings, I think many times, if I'm not wrong, either in the book of leadership or on the book which is a compilation of Swami's discourses to students of the MBA program.
Man management.
Right. I think Swami has made it very clear that for youth, to read about the lives of saints is very, very important. It's a swadhyaya which Swami has himself spoken of. Because Swami says, you imbibe their goodness, you imbibe their qualities. On many occasions, in fact, another devotee was once saying, he was carrying, I think, a book in his hand when Swami called him for an interview. And I think he was also giving some lectures in the MBA class or to some of the students. So Swami looked at the book and Swami asked, what book is it? And he said, Swami, it's about values in business or whatever it is. And to him, Swami had told, see, when you pick up a book to read, it should be about a person of good character, and or it should be written by a person of good character. So Swami said, if you're taking general books on general subjects, ensure that the author is a person of good character. Right? Mm. It makes it all the more difficult to stray away from Sai literature. Right? Mm. You have to eventually end up in this. But Swami has said, probably the best, even before we go into what answer Swami gives, a fair amount of idea we can get by merely looking at the dramas which have been staged in Swami's presence. Mm. Because those are the characters whom Swami has spoken highly of, and Swami has allowed the students to dramatize. In fact, there's a beautiful discourse which these Kerala youth had once selected and played in the mandir, where Swami is saying that, you know, the dramas which are in Swami's presence are not for entertainment. Mm. Those are specifically about people whose qualities are worth emulating in this world. The students benefit by enacting those dramas, and by seeing it, the devotees benefit by listening to those stories. So in that sense, that of Adi Shankara, I think maximum number of staged is the Bhajagovindam drama. And then you have Jayadeva, you have Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Swami has himself done. Ramakrishna Paramahamsa multiple times. Tyagaraja any number of times.
Vivekananda,
Mirabai any number of times. So all of these characters whom Swami has spoken about. Kabir is one saint whom Swami would speak very highly of.
Both the Ramdasas, Samartha Ramdas, right, and Bhadrachala Ramdas.
Tulsidas, the other one from one more Das, not getting the name. Kanakadasa Swami has spoken about, Swami would quote his. So a lot of these saints Swami has spoken of in his discourses. So if devotees are wondering what are those saints whom Swami has approved of, these are the many. Namdev is another.
Tukaram,
Namdev. So let's see what Swami is telling in this particular conversation.
Swami says, Ramakrishna started as a devotee of God. There was Mother Kali and himself. They were separate. A duality existed. At one point, he engaged in a certain action and Mother Kali never appeared to him again. Towards the end, he merged in God and was God realized. Hislop adds, Shankara and Ramana Maharshi were also similar cases? And Swami says, yes. Then Hislop says, perhaps Buddha was a messenger of God. Hislop says this because when Swami asks what is a saint, he says saint is a messenger of God, and names these people. And all of them, Swami says, they became God realized. Meaning it's not like a messenger of God, they are not separate from God. And that's why Hislop says, perhaps Buddha is a messenger of God. Swami says, Buddha never mentioned God also. The story is known that he was a prince with wife and child, that when he saw misery and death, he was determined to find their cause. For years he engaged in severe austerities. He made three announcements. All is suffering, all is transient, all is void. I think it is Sarvam Kshanikam, Sarvam Dukkham, Sarvam Shunyam. These were the three things, that statements that he made. And when Swami says this, Hislop says, then Buddha did not realize God but realized Nirvana? Very interesting over here, because you know, when we generally read, we assume Nirvana to be God realization. But Swami says Buddha never mentioned God, and that's true. Buddhism doesn't have God. There's no form. So Swami says that what Buddha sought, it actually comes in the next statement itself. Swami says yes for that. When Hislop says Buddha did not realize God but realized Nirvana, Swami says yes, and Hislop adds a note that on a previous occasion, Sai had said that one found that for which he sought, and the Buddha had searched for the cause of sorrow. So Swami says that you will find what you seek. And that's why Swami says, seek that seeking which you will never have to seek again. In Buddha's case, he sought to find the cause of sorrow. And finding the cause of sorrow is what is possibly described as Nirvana, because that is what he found. But I think Swami says it is different from God realization, because in my humble opinion, possibly God realization is the search for the cause of bliss, possibly. While here it was a search for the cause of sorrow. So this was my understanding of what Swami possibly meant. But Swami says that Buddha never mentioned God, and he did not realize God, but he realized Nirvana, right, which is finding the cause for suffering.
Exactly. As you said, I don't think you and I are qualified to speak about that as such. Swami has spoken about this on many occasions. In one discourse, Swami says that Buddha never spoke about God, but Buddha spoke about compassion. He spoke about love. And how can that not be God? Right? So Swami had mentioned that in one of the discourses. But the difference which Swami is making, as you pointed out, is very clear. He went out in search of a relief from pain. You know, that is what, and in fact, one of the things which he says in the end is, I think he speaks about three or four truths, which is spoken of as, in that he speaks of dukkha as one of the truths of life. Saying that there's no way of escaping it.
Exactly. Sarvam dukkham.
Right.
Sarvam chanikam, sarvam shunyam.
And you have to accept that, I think, the dukkha, samudaya and nirvana and something he speaks of.
Okay.
So where he says that you serve the society, then there is nirvana to be attained and you can attain it, something of that sort. Where he says that you have to accept, till you don't accept old age, till you don't accept death, till you don't accept pain, you will only be suffering. And one of the ways of putting an end to suffering is to accept it as the reality of life. And the way Swami is speaking about here, in fact, that is a strain in the conversation you can notice all through. Swami's emphasis, at least in his conversation or his dialogue with Hislop, has been on bhakti. On so many occasions, you can see that Swami is trying to push the idea of bhakti. One is just to look at it as, we all know that Swami gave a lot of importance to that, because that is one of the easier and more beautiful paths for the Kali age. And also, as a devotee, Hislop must have had much more need for this than to speak about, you know, general enlightenment and nirvana and meditation and all of that. So both of this, so in that sense, Swami is, and of course, we also know the background of Hislop. He comes from the Vipassana tradition. And there was a conversation, I think, before this, or it is going to come, where he asks about Vipassana. And, you know, Swami acknowledges all the experiences. But Swami says it is not the ultimate. It is one of the ways by which you discipline the body and the mind. You cannot get stuck there. And that is one of the reasons why Swami would always keep an ideal which is way higher, so that you don't, you know, low aim is a crime, as Swami would say. You keep a lesser target for yourself and you're happy that you've reached there. So Swami, that's one of the reasons probably Swami would always give himself as the example, so that you know till you reach him or till you reach his state, you're not done. You never give up till that last point.
Continuing, Swami says, yes, there is only one yoga and that is bhakti yoga. All the others, kriya yoga, hatha yoga, the so-called Sai Yoga, Pranayama, all the methods and techniques known as yogas belong to the body. They are like drill exercises. Right, left, up, down. Where is the result? They are worthless and a waste of time. Bhakti Yoga is the direct path to God. It is the easy way. All others are useless. There are six types of bhakti, and madhura means sweet. That is the highest type. I mean, there are a couple of sweeping statements here. Swami literally says all others are useless. You know, So either it is very particularly for Hislop or particularly for this age. But in some context, Swami is saying that other than bhakti, everything else is useless. It's of no use at all. They are all tools that help you, but help you, assist you, but without bhakti, all of them become useless, and therefore focus on bhakti. And in that bhakti also, Swami gives madhura bhakti the prime spot.
Right, and it is not just for Hislop also. I mean, one of the best ways to find out what is the prescribed path that Swami speaks about, or what is the path that Swami has endorsed more than the others, you only have to look at the ashram schedule or the hostel schedule, right? Because here were people on whose lives, you can say, Swami had a fair amount of control, in the sense that he was deciding what would be their schedule, he was deciding what would be their sadhana, or the tasks they would perform on a daily basis. And what he chose for them is pretty much what Swami felt is the average lifestyle that a sadhaka needs to lead. For instance, you know, when the discussion about veganism comes, if it was so very necessary for a spiritual path, Swami would have stopped it in the hostel. Swami would not have served milk. Some people ask about onions and garlic and things like that in the diet. There are some people who say that those have to be avoided for the spiritual person. But you can see the canteens in the ashram do not avoid it in that sense. So Swami did not find that as a mandatory thing. I mean, as a special case, if you wanted to be a little more strict with yourself and follow a stricter discipline, Swami would not say no about it. But these are the things which Swami says that bare minimum you start off with. So in that sense, be it Kriya Yoga or any kind of Kundalini meditation or anything like that, Swami is not encouraging anything. Swami, the things which Swami has encouraged, bhajan singing, you do seva, and very, very simple, you just lead a good life is what Swami would say. You lead a dharmic life, you lead a life by which you are useful to the people around you, and you don't harm anybody around. And as simple as it may sound, it takes a lifetime to lead a life like that. It is not easy. It has got enough distractions to ensure that even that does not remain a simple precept to follow.
What I think is, Prem, like, you know, any time, whether it's academics or any other thing where we are trying to achieve perfection, we often move quickly to 80-90%.
Right.
And it's from 90% on, it becomes real difficult. So I feel even in spirituality, there are some possibly techniques or some things that are prescribed to help those who are at 90-95% to fine-tune and reach 96 or a little bit, you know. Because even in some of the classes that I have studied, there used to be a special class for the students who are at the bottom of the class, but there used to be a special class for those who are at the top of the class as well. And I used to get frustrated thinking that, you know, wherever you are in the class, you have a special class. And the idea was that it's a different kind of fine-tuning. But you know what? These fine-tuning techniques is of no use. In fact, it will collapse if given to somebody who is at a 30% or a 40% stage. For that, you need something else, totally different. I think in that sense, bhakti is a combination of a gross as well as a fine-tuning technique. I mean, it can take a person who is at 90% also to 100. It can take a person who is at 70 also to 100. It can take a person who has not yet started, who is at 0 also to 100. So, for me, it feels like Swami is saying, when you have this all-rounded, complete, wholesome method, why are you trying to focus on, yeah, if you like that, yeah, you do it, it's fine. But it's not mandatory. What is mandatory, what is most important is bhakti. And this, and Swami also defined what is devotion, what is bhakti, and what are the ways to inculcate bhakti. This is my understanding because, as you rightly said, you just cannot miss the fact that Swami has laid much more emphasis on bhakti compared to jnana or karma. Even when you, I remember reading in one of the discourses where Swami said, seva, what is seva? Swami said, seva is bhakti to the Vishva Virata Swarupa of the Lord. Offering your devotion to the cosmic form of the Lord is seva. So seva is also defined as bhakti. And even if you look at, you know, bhakti translates as love for God. If we look at the values that are dearest to God, dearest to Swami, Satya, Dharma, Shanti, Prema, if they have to be further, you know, simplified into one, it is only love, because Swami says love in words is satya, love in action is dharma, love in your thoughts is shanti and prema. So you know, it's almost like the core, the basic fundamental, the highest common factor and the lowest common multiple both together is love, and that love directed towards God, which is bhakti. This is my understanding on why Swami lays so much emphasis on bhakti and bhakti alone.
And many times what happens is, you know, when we think of taking up some spiritual practice, I think it invariably you're looking for something special that stands out. That's how the ego works. Even in the path of spirituality, you always want to do something which makes you stand apart from the rest. But if you really look at it, when Swami speaks about karma yoga, or when Swami speaks about meditation for that matter, Swami always talks of the ability to do that particular act without having any kind of botheration or worry about what will be the results that come from that. And if you look at it, overall, whatever path you take, it is easy to do it that way if you have bhakti. You're not bothered, should I do Kriya Yoga, should I do this special kind of meditation? He said, Swami, I'll do bhajans. If at all I need it, you're going to make me do it. You know, you're going to probably guide me in a manner that I have to pick that up as one of my sadhanas. So that kind of a freedom which is there, it's like you're not bothered about what am I supposed to do to reach the goal. This is what Swami has said, I will do this. And if at all there is a need, as you're saying, if I've reached that 90% mark, and if Swami feels that I need that extra coaching to get from 90 to 99, that's Swami's headache. It's not my trouble. So I think that is why bhakti kind of enhances every practice. If you're a seva, as you said, as you're a person, if you're taken to service, with bhakti, if you're able to look at it that way, as Swami said, you're only serving the Vishwavirata Rupa of the Lord, the way you'll serve will be completely different.
Absolutely.
The same meditation gets more sweeter when you do it with bhakti. The same reading of Advaita or Vedanta becomes even more... the experience is completely different when it is done with bhakti.
Yes, I think, like you rightly said, without that bhakti aspect, whether it is seva or meditation or, you know, reading Advaita, all of them become like chores. And I think that is the reason why possibly, if I'm getting bored reading a discourse by Bhagwan, it's possibly because I'm doing it like a normal reading, like how I would read a novel or read a story. Because there it is the mind that is enjoying, and once the devotion comes in, I think everything will be so beautiful. Like Swami gives the example of the Gopikas. Just seeing that it is Krishna's writing, that's it. They were lost in such tears, they couldn't proceed beyond one word. So that is the magic of bhakti. And you know, I think definitely we should pray. I think that's why the bhajan is also there. Mujhe bhakti do, mujhe shakti do, you know. Bhakti is something that if we get, everything else automatically gets endowed. I think we should also learn possibly what is like true bhakti. Swami explains that, and while explaining why Madhura bhakti is the highest kind of bhakti. But I think we'll come to that after a quick little break. Don't go anywhere, dear listeners. On the other side of the break, we'll continue with what is Madhura Bhakti and the examples that Swami gives.
Amritam, Muritinche, Prema Amritam.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Hislop now asks Swami, what makes Madhura, that is Madhura Bhakti, the highest? And Swami replies, in this, the devotee sees everything as God. When Jayadeva would lift his clothes to put on, he would see Krishna in the garments and would not treat him as clothes. I mean, would not treat them as clothes. He would go about the streets unclothed, and people would put a garment around him. He would talk with Krishna, sing to Krishna, dance with Krishna, merge with Krishna and fall senseless. He was like the guru of Chaitanya. And Hislop says, Swami, the description sounds somewhat like Ramakrishna Paramahamsa. Swami says, Jayadeva, Chaitanya, Ramakrishna are in this Madhura stream of bhakti. Jayadeva saw himself as the bride of Krishna, and because of this his songs are taken by the public with a worldly meaning as being lustful, whereas the true meanings, the meanings they had for Jayadeva, are quite different. To himself the heart was the bride, he was the Atma. So Swami explains what is Madhura Bhakti, and we see how it is. It's almost like, in a worldly sense, they are mad. As Swami would say, there are two kinds of mad people. one the worldly mad, one the God mad. For the worldly mad, the God mad appear to be mad. For the God mad, the worldly mad appear to be mad. And then Swami would add, of all the madnesses that inflict man, God madness is the least harmful and the most beneficial. So, is it a coincidence that even Madhura Bhakti begins as Madura Bhakti, you know? It is like a kind of madness where you see Swami in everything. You know, we pine and we think, oh, we're missing you, Swami, we are not able to see you. They are like the polar opposites of our feeling. They are not able to see anything other than Swami. Like in the studio, they see the curtain as Swami, the mic as Swami, the table as Swami. Everything is Swami and their life is therefore filled with Swami. Like how Swami says, I am above you, below you, around you, everywhere, near you, in you. They are actually living that experience.
And I think even in the 40s and 50s, Mrs. Vijay Kumari from the Kuppam family, she used to say how extensively Swami would speak to them about Madhur Bhakti. Swami would speak about the Gopikas, Swami would speak about the Bhakti of Radha. In fact, I think she even authored a book compiling many of these called Madhur Bhakti. So Swami has spoken about it, and if you really look at it, and when you read about someone like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, you read about someone like Jayadeva running around unclothed because of the feeling that you had, honestly, it is way, way beyond something we can even imagine. Can anybody love God like that? I mean, if not for Swami, we would have never been able to relate to it. It's not that we are in that state where we are able to, you know, love Swami like that, but I'm sure every devotee has had at least one moment of such madness, where, you know, you at least for one moment you'd have said that I don't need anything else. I can give up everything else. And anyone who's, even when you're talking about that craving for Swami, or really when Swami has not spoken to you when you needed him, or, you know, Swami has his own ways of creating situations where he can do that to each devotee, whether he's close, he's far, he's physically someone whom Swami speaks to, a student, non-student, doesn't matter. If Swami wants to put you through that pain of craving, he can put you through that pain. And anyone who has been in that pain of craving, if you had gone and told them, would you like to exchange this pain for anything else, they would have said no. Right? And I think that is the Madhura Bhakti which Swami is speaking about. There is pain, there is tears, there is craving, but there is sweetness in that. And the word Madhuram itself means sweetness. So a kind of bhakti which comes out of that, you know, anything that you do, whether you're crying or whether you're happy, you know, like how Swami would speak of Radha. She said, you're everywhere. You're in the water, you're in the leaf, you're in everything. Whether you see him in everything or you're craving to see him, like Meera, both become sweet. And Swami is referring to that as Madhura Bhakti probably. And really, if not for Swami, I don't think even that one moment of that sweetness we would have had the opportunity to experience.
Absolutely, Prem. When you say about madness for Swami, and all of us would have gone through one such moment, you know, I remember, and I'm sure you also remember, in fact, he was your classmate. In this moment of madness, he had written a letter to Swami, and I remember in Thrai Brindavan, Swami read that letter, materialized a ring for him and gave him, and then Swami told him, don't do like this again. And I was wondering what was the whole thing about. It was only later we got to know that, you know, out of his love for Swami and combined with this moment of madness, what was on the paper was not red ink but his own blood. You know, he had actually taken out blood and dipped, and with a quill had written a letter. You know, these are the kind of mad things that, you know, people possibly do. It is not the right thing to be done because Swami said no, but Swami accepted that love. Swami knew what it is. Because the sequence of events were so strange in Thrai Brindavan. Here is Swami accepting and Swami is saying don't do this. But what you are saying, don't do it, you only rewarded him with a ring right now, you know. It was such a thing, and I'm sure if somebody had tried to do it for the sake of getting a ring after that.
In fact, immediately after that Swami said, taking clue from this, if any of you write tomorrow in the same manner, I'll throw you out.
From that, you know, it becomes clear that it is not just about doing an act of madness. It has to be a spontaneous outpouring. You know, when we speak to that boy later on, we get to know that it was not something that he planned and focused and did. It was a kind of mad outpouring that came out in that fashion. So, So, I'm just, you know, trying to find logic in an experience.
In fact, if you recall, there's a video which we were seeing the other day where Swami is speaking in Kodaikanal. Swami was reading out a letter of a student and Swami was speaking
about that. Oh, yes. Correct.
Right?
Yeah, I recollected. I think it has been even made into a product called Darshan Part 4. So, Swami is saying there about, he's reading out a letter of a boy who is saying, Swami, I'm so, I miss you so much. I want to be with you. If you don't give me darshan, Swami, I'm going to go in the lake and drown myself.
Right. Swami was in Kodai and this boy was not part of the Kodai trip.
He was not part of Swami's entourage.
He was sitting outside in Darshan and he had written this letter.
And Swami is reading out all this. And then Swami also says, you know, little emotional. When they get emotional, they become like this. Not right. Should not be done. Swami says it should not be done. And as a viewer, it leaves you wondering, Swami, if this is not the right thing to be done, why are you reading it aloud? Because it is a spontaneous outpouring.
Exactly. In fact, Swami says it is not, you should not encourage such thoughts of, you know, taking your life and all that. But Swami, in the course of that thing, Swami says, but he's having that pain. He really is yearning like that. I mean, how fortunate it is to hear from Swami that, that yearning is true. Because so many of us yearn so many times and as Swami would say, this is emotion, I've seen so many people like this. Swami would say all of that. But to have that acknowledgement from Swami that yes, this is true yearning. Though, the way he has expressed it is not right. This, he truly is yearning. And Swami says something like, no, I will speak to him. I will.
Yes, Swami says, I will speak to him.
Right.
Actually, first Swami reads out the letter. And when Swami reads out the letter, everybody is in a kind of shocked silence because what is the content of this letter? Then Swami criticizes, says, no, this is not the right thing to be done. But after that, Swami says, no, no, I will respond because he's truly having this yearning. I feel, you know, when we listen to Swami speak about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, which is going to happen next, when he speaks about Jayadeva, we in our heart think how blessed Jayadeva is that the Lord is remembering him now. I think our generation, we have been so blessed in the sense that we got an opportunity to witness God do this. I think this boy about whom Swami is speaking there in Kodaikanal is equally blessed like Jayadeva or Chaitanya to have the Lord speak about you. And we don't know the complex workings of karma and fate and destiny. For all you know, many of these souls who have been around Swami physically have been souls that have been great devotees for many, many lifetimes, have just not yet taken up moksha because they possibly wanted to spend some moments in the physical presence of Bhagwan.
You know, so many times there was one other interaction in Kodaikanal I was listening to where Swami was speaking about some of these Sevadal who come from very, very poor economic background. A lot of them come from places like Srikakulam and Adilabad. They're economically very, very poor. They come, Swami says, you know, say they have nothing. There is nothing I give them. I don't even speak to them. I don't even call them for an interview. They're ready to put up with anything. We don't give them proper food. Swami is saying all this to the students. We don't give them proper food. We don't give them proper accommodation. You make them work for a few hours every day. But they are ready to put up with everything. Why? Because that devotee is thinking at the end of 15 days, I can touch Swami's feet. So Swami was saying that, see, that is the love. And I mean, as you're saying, each one of those Sevadal is blessed because Swami is talking about that person. Swami is acknowledging that focus that they had. And really, in that sense, we are so fortunate. How many times, almost every Thrai session used to be of Swami remembering some devotee, of Swami speaking of some devotee from the 40s, 50s, or some past student who had passed a few years ago.
In fact, when you say Thrai, I remember one Swami started speaking about the ladies who put Rangoli.
Right.
Started speaking about them at great length and I was just thinking how, you know, I don't know if this will get conveyed to them, whoever is doing it, but many years after that Thrai session, you know, as late as even 2008, 2009, even to this day, on those rare occasions when I'm awake that early in the morning and, you know, walk, you should look at some of these women who do the Rangoli. They might easily be in their 80s or 90s. Some of them, they're so old in the sense that their vertebral column has bent. And yet with the hunchback, they come and clean the whole area with water and draw such huge Rangoli designs, floral designs. It's amazing. And Swami has remembered them. I mean, if you look at it from a human point of view, what is the number of tasks that I have versus what is the number of tasks that Swami has. I myself am not able to remember or think of this, but Swami is thinking and spending time on them, talking in detail about them, of how much love they have, with what feeling they do it. It's amazing. It's really amazing. And again, all of this just highlights bhakti, bhakti, bhakti.
Absolutely. And Swami speaks about, in the next one, Hislop asked this question about what kind of person was Chaitanya, referring to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And Swami replies, Chaitanya also would sing to Krishna and dance in ecstasy with Krishna. Once he visited an admirer, he was lodged in a room next to the prayer hall, and whenever food was offered to the metal idol of Krishna, Chaitanya was observed to be eating that same food in his room. The host decided to make a test. He locked Chaitanya in his room, and there was some opening through which he could see Chaitanya. Then food was offered to Krishna idol, and Chaitanya was again seen to be eating that food. The host entered the room and slapped Chaitanya on both cheeks. Upon this, the metal idol of Krishna disappeared, and this caused great worry, and prayers were made to Krishna. Krishna then appeared to the devotee and said, "You offered food to me and then slapped me when I ate it, so I went away." Swami is narrating a beautiful episode from
the life of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu.
Chaitanya Mahaprabhu.
You know, when the devotee starts seeing the Lord everywhere, it's almost like the Lord is seeing himself in the devotee. The Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, at least, I think on three occasions, in my brief stint as a student, I have seen the Chaitanya Mahaprabhu being enacted three times. And so many have been the dramas. And in all the dramas, the focus of bringing Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in is to show the yearning and longing that he had for Krishna. There would be that unforgettable scene where he's walking here and there and seeing Krishna everywhere, and yet just before finding Krishna, Krishna seems to be elusive. I think that was Akhiya Sham Darish Ke Pyasi. You know what, Prem? I think it's a good idea that before we proceed further, we can just listen to that song from one of the dramas. As I said, dear listeners, this Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, this particular scene has been enacted multiple times in multiple dramas. So this is one such song from one such drama.
Thank you. तुम्हारे द्वार पुकारो, श्याम तुम्हारे द्वार पुकारो, अखिया दर्श की प्यासी, अखिया दर्श की प्यासी, अखिया दर्श की प्यासी.
That was the song from the from a drama which was staged in 1993, and from, as you said, multiple times, this was a character which was portrayed. And as we were mentioning, many of these saints, if we are wondering who are the saints whom Swami has endorsed, spoken about, was held as ideals for Swami students, I think these are the ones: Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and many of these. So, and Swami always encouraged this. And if you read some of the letters that Swami would write to the students in Vrindavan, or for that matter, even the conversations that we have gone through, Swami would always speak about that yearning. You should always have that. And of course, when it comes to students, Swami would always say that the yearning must transform you. It is no point in simply sitting there and saying that I want Swami, or I want to be near Swami. Swami would say that the letters which Swami would write, interestingly, it was titled Premadhara. Swami's love was flowing through those letters. Swami would say that, are you thinking of Swami all the time? Swami would write in those letters, and are you thinking of Swami, and are you ensuring that every act that you perform is an act which is suitable to be offered to Swami? So when Swami speaks about Madhura Bhakti, it is not just an emotional way by which you connect to Swami, you just think of Swami. It is about you ensuring that every aspect of life gets touched by that love that you have for Swami.
You know, speaking of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Swami is so eager to speak about him. Like, you know, those who have yearned for him, it is seen that Swami also yearns for such devotees, because even as Swami narrates that incident where he ends by saying, "You offered food to me and then slapped me when I ate, so I went away." At that point in time, Hislop actually starts speaking something. Hislop says, "Oh, his devotion had..." But then again, Swami, you know, midway cuts him, because it is evident even in the book when we read that Swami is so eager to speak about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Swami says, cutting Hislop midway in a sentence, Swami says, "Chaitanya had Satyananda as a guru at one time. The guru wanted to test the devotion of Chaitanya. He placed a cube of sugar on Chaitanya's tongue and said to him to keep it there until he returned from the river. At the river, the guru bathed, washed clothes, did his singing, and was away for some 2 hours. On returning, he found Chaitanya with his mouth still open and the cube of sugar vibrating somewhat, but intact on the tongue without melting. Realizing Chaitanya's greatness and that his control of the senses was so complete, he prostrated and declared that Chaitanya was his guru." You know, with this incident, I think we can get different indicators of what this Madhura Bhakti is. One, we saw Madhura Bhakti is that which makes you forget everything else and see, you know, God in everything. The other thing is, you have absolute sense control, because now it is God who is in total control of your life. You are seeing God everywhere. I mean, your eyes are seeing Swami. Your ears are hearing Swami. You are feeling Swami. You are breathing in Swami. So when the senses are saturated with divinity in this manner, they cannot lead you astray. That is why it is, I think Swami narrates this to show the kind of sense control that is there. It is very, very difficult. In fact, I tried this out while reading this. You put a sugar on your tongue, even if you consciously choose not to eat it, I mean, the body automatically salivates and, you know, the sugar cube melts in no time. That is how powerful the senses are. To be absolutely unfocused on it, to be absolutely detached from it, you definitely have to be intensely focused elsewhere. Otherwise, it's not possible. Because as I said, I also put my tongue out and consciously I have decided I am not going to eat this sugar. But since I'm just conscious of the sugar on my tongue, that is enough for the saliva to ooze and, you know, finish off that sugar. So if I have to be so defocused from that sugar, I have to be intensely focused elsewhere. And I think that is very evident in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's life. His focus on God was so intense that he was totally defocused from everything that belonged to this world.
In fact, when you're talking about the drama which was staged in Swami's presence, one of the most iconic scenes in that drama was actually Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was, I forgot his name before he took on the name Chaitanya Mahaprabhu.
Gauranga.
Gauranga, I think. He was a teacher of Sanskrit grammar. That was his profession. He used to have a lot of students, he used to teach. There's one scene in which, you know, he's taking a class and then he suddenly says, oh, Krishna is there, and he starts running towards that corner and he faints. And then he wakes up and then he finds that all the students are still sitting in the class. And then he says, I'm sorry, I actually lost myself. And then one of the students gets up and says, Master, this is not the first time. You've not taken any class for the past few months. You every time start like this and then you lose yourself in Krishna consciousness. So it is not only that sugar kept on him, he's totally distracted from it and he's thinking of the Lord. He's not able to do anything. He is in a state where he's completely lost. And very beautifully in that drama, that's how Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says that this mind is incapable of thinking of anything else now. If there's one thing I can teach, it is only to take the name of the Lord.
Wow.
So he says, if you want to learn that, you can continue to be my disciples or you're all free to go. And that's how they all become disciples of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And Swami would say of, you know, how he is one of the pioneers of Sankirtana, where they would take instruments into the streets and they would sing the name of Krishna.
Group singing.
And people would, you know, get so irritated with that and they broke the instruments. Then he started taking cymbals and started playing that and chanting the name. Swami says that also was taken away. And finally he starts clapping his hands and singing. Swami would say that is why in bhajans today we all clap hands. You don't need instruments to take the name of the Lord. So
that is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's contribution to all our bhakti in that sense. After this, Hislop asks a question that will naturally arise in many of our minds, which is, Swami, are there such complete devotees living today, such as Jayadeva and Chaitanya? And Swami says, oh yes, there are. But mostly they contain the devotion within themselves. Sometime it shows, and the world judges the person to be of unsound mind. Swami has encountered such devotees, but he does not grant interviews. But the people live filled with joy. There was one such, a Rani, a queen, who was encountered a few years ago. It was not appropriate to the situation to grant interview. So, Swami makes it clear that there are many like that, but they choose not to, like when you say that, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was least interested in taking class or tasting sugar or anything. Where will such a person have the interest to show others that, you know, he is God realized? Or I think in another context in the same conversation, Swami says that if you go to such a God realized person, he won't have any interest in guiding you and ensuring your progress. They are so lost to the world, they are so intoxicated in God that they don't see the need to build an ashram, have disciples and, you know, grow. I mean, when I say grow, I'm meaning it in the worldly sense. So that is what Swami says here. There are many such devotees. And Swami says he does not grant interviews because from a societal point of view, it's not proper. And he gives the example of a queen whom Swami says that she was in that state, but it was not appropriate to give her an interview. Many times, you know, when I go for my evening walk, I come across, in the worldly sense, what we call mad people. There is one lady, trust me, Prem, I've been seeing her from like 12 or 14 years now, maybe. Why 14? 2003, yeah. 17 years now. A lady who will be muttering nonsense, loud voice, walking on the road, you know. And sometimes she'll tie a plastic bag as her slipper. I've seen this lady in Puttaparthi. Like that, I've seen different mad people, but this lady I've seen consistently. You know, it only a few years back struck me that possibly it's not right to think of all these people as mad people because you don't know the truth. You know, when I look at this lady, I just think every year, so many times I get cold, I get fever, I get cough, I get sick despite all the good care I take of myself. And I'm thinking, this lady is roaming the street from 17 years, nothing. I honestly assumed that she would be dead by now. This whole thing got triggered because 3 days back when I went for a walk, I again saw her on the street and she was still there. I just felt, oh my God, what is keeping her alive? So we really don't know. Like Swami says, we think that a person who is God-realized and living like this, yeah, will be clean, neat, sitting, bearded, possibly levitating or something like that. For all that you know, that person whom you considered as a mad person and moved away from could be one such God-realized. Because one of the basic definitions of God-realization is absolute detachment from the world, which means you absolutely don't care what people think about you, what they do to you, anything like that. So that's what Swami says here.
And the encouraging thing, of course, is Swami says there are many, many people like that. And in fact, Hislop goes on to ask, is it possible for a Western person to be such a great bhakta? And Swami says, oh yes, quite possible. But Swami, for an office holder who has Swami's work to do in the world, which is the best bhakti? And Swami says the same. But how could one do work if we were to be like that, Swami asks Hislop. Swami says, it is quite possible to do work and at the same time be the highest bhakta. It is the feeling that is important for the work. Even in the case of Jayadeva and Chaitanya, their influence was widespread, which means it is not that they did not perform any task of importance to the society or from the society's point of view for that matter. Jayadeva is, his literary contribution is immense. In the same way, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu guided so many devotees, Ramakrishna Paramahamsa for that matter. You know, though we all speak of him as being lost in his bliss with union with God and all of that, at the same time, he guided so many of those people in their spiritual path. Vivekananda or Brahmananda, all of them, apart from being attracted to Ramakrishna Paramahamsa because of his devotion to God, he was giving them very, very wise counsel as a spiritual master.
No doubt, Prem, that Ramakrishna Paramahamsa did a lot of work. Today, if you look at the Ramakrishna mission, where is the inspiration from? It is from Ramakrishna only. All these people have done such work of lasting impact. So, as Swami says, it is possible that you can do both. In fact, I am reminded of my favorite incident, which I have quoted many times, of how during one of the earlier Gram Sevas, I am speaking of the Gram Sevas being done in the 1980s, Swami once and came out and began to speak to the students about one particular lady. Her name is Radhamma. And Swami mentioned that she is the best midwife in the world. She assists in deliveries, childbirth, when no immediate doctor or hospital facilities are available. And then the interesting thing is Swami asked the students, why is she the best midwife in the world? When nobody had an answer, Swami himself replied, while doing any delivery, she always prays to Swami, thinks of Swami and tells Swami, you are doing this, I am just an instrument. And then Swami added, when I do this, it has to be the best, right? So, it is possible that we do any kind of mundane worldly work also, bringing in this bhakti. We cannot say that, you know, I am working in the accounts department, how can I have devotion? When I do work, how can I make my work my worship? Because people may think, easy for you to speak, you're working in Radio Sai. You know, everything is Swami, so easy for you to have bhakti. I would definitely like to state, and I'm sure Prem, you'll also agree that even if it is Swami's own discourses and Swami's videos that we are working on, one cannot take for granted that bhakti is an automatic side effect. No. Our sadhana, our effort has to go in whether we are working in Radio Sai or whether I am working in the accounts department or whether I am working anywhere, you know, whatever, whether I am doing a menial job or whether I am doing a mental job or I am doing a psychological job. There has to be effort from our side, yearning from our side. And once that yearning is there, irrespective of what job is being done, it helps to grow in devotion. That's what Swami says. It is possible to do work and at the same time be the highest bhakta, because it is a feeling that is important, not the work. When Swami says it's the feeling and not the work, I think it holds good here also. Nobody can just say that, it's very easy for you to be devoted because you are in Radio Sai. The work is not important. It's the feeling that matters. The even here, even if I'm working in Radio Sai, I'm not guaranteed devotion and, you know, God's grace unless I put in my efforts to develop that feeling.
Right. And I mean, the best example you can think of where Swami says that even being a devotee in this state, you still can do God's work. I think what better example can you think of other than Lord Hanuman, who says that, you know, you speak of him as the best example for Dasya Bhakti. At the same time, he's somebody who is, anytime the Lord's name is sung or anytime the Lord's story is spoken, he is one who's sitting there lost in raptures. You know, that's what they say, that the very beautiful shloka which is said, Yatra Yatra Raghunatha Kirtanam, Tatra Tatra Krita Mastaka Anjalim. He says that his hands are raised above his head and his eyes are filled with tears. And that is, of course, the best description of Madhur Bhakti. But at the same time, whenever there is a work for the Lord, he's there. In fact, I think in the conversation, there was one part where Swami was telling about how you do work with devotion. So Swami says it's not like you have to think of God at that time. At that time, the work itself becomes God. That the way you perfectly execute what is in front of you, that becomes an offering. That becomes the way in which you express your devotion. And I don't think these are all states that you can consciously labor and reach. It is not like tomorrow if I want to cry like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu or I want to lose myself in Krishna like Jayadeva, it is possible. It is a, you know, you have to do what is right at this moment and eventually you get rewarded with that kind of a union with Swami in thoughts, I guess.
Absolutely. You know, just yesterday, Ruchi Desai sir, our Vrindavan commerce teacher, he was narrating an incident, you know, of a person who came to meet him because Swami had told him to meet him. And he indeed got confirmation that Swami had told this person to go and meet Ruchi Desai sir. And he had a CD which he said that he wanted to produce and donate which could be sold. The story that this man said was amazing. This person was a music composer from Italy. And one day when he was walking, I don't know which town in Italy he was walking there, he suddenly hears a voice and he's mesmerized with that voice. And the first thought that arises in him listening to that voice is, hey, this must be the voice of God. It can't be anything else. I must find it. So he goes knocking on different doors to locate where is that voice coming from. And finally he lands up in a house, a Sai devotee's house, where Swami's discourse is being played. And that is how he finds out about Satya Sai Baba and lands up in India. And you know, we have a set of beautiful, beautifully tuned shlokas that Swami has sung. Not shlokas, padyams. You know, I remember Khanda Khandantara. Even if we, you know, go to some of the other padyams, which is Allah Yanchu, Muhammad Yulu. Long padyams that Swami has sung at the beginning of the discourse, we have them being set to beautiful Western chords and music, and it's such a pleasure and joy to listen to them. It has been done by this person, and he is the one who contributed this. And it is so amazing to know that he got to know Swami through the voice. What it is not something that you can achieve through effort. We have heard Swami's voice so many times. Here was a person who didn't know who Swami is, got pulled, just hearing the voice. And he concluded, just listening to what Swami was singing or speaking at that point in time, he concluded that this must be God's voice. That is the, you know, those are the kind of devotees that we see in the world today. Those are the kind of amazing experiences that people have had. It's just wonderful. And as you said, all that we can do is do our little bit, take care of the present moment, do what is right in this moment, and hope that we also grow in our love and yearning for Swami.
Right. And at this point, it's a very, very beautiful statement that Swami makes. And I don't know in what tone it was made, but when you read it, it really feels very, very awesome the way Swami puts it. After listening to all of this Hisla Pass, Swami, it seems to be the case that from the time of Krishna to Satya Sai, there has been no opportunity. And I think he's just framing the sentence when Swami literally cuts him there, and Swami says, interrupts him and says, time, I am Krishna, where is time? See, he says that from the time of Krishna to now, Swami says, I am Krishna, where is time? A very beautiful and very powerful declaration that Swami makes. I don't know whether he slept, took a pause and really absorbed that moment, but it was so profound the way Swami put it. But
I don't think he had even time to absorb, because here Swami makes one after another. You know, Hislop says, Swami, I mean, between the time of the Krishna body and the Satyasai body, there has been no opportunity to have God himself as one's guru. And Swami says, until the Shirdi body. Then Swami, this has to be the best time for people to be born. Swami says, yes, the very best time, even better than during the lifetime of the Krishna body. Now, this is something is so superb, so, you know, we realize what a great blessing it is that has been conferred on us, that we have come to know of the Satyasai avatar. I think just contemplating on this one sentence is enough for us to wake up every morning with gratitude, go to bed every night with gratitude. When I wake up in the morning, I should close my eyes and tell Swami, thank you that I'm able to tell Swami. If not for your love and grace, I wouldn't have said Swami in my life anytime. I'm so grateful to you, Swami. Let us wake up with that gratitude in our heart. Forget everything else. Forget all our problems or all our complaints. Complaints which may range from financial to relationship to health to whatever. All those become so minuscule when we realize the magnitude of the blessing that has been conferred on us. The knowledge, the awareness of Swami in our lives, Swami's presence in our lives, Swami as God in our lives. I think we should definitely spend every morning and every night at the least to remember this great blessing and be grateful to Swami.
Absolutely. If you read the life of all of these saints, what Swami is saying here, especially about the idea of Madhura Bhakti, whenever Swami speaks about Radha, Swami would say that she had reached a state where she did not even need the Lord in the form. When Krishna himself came, she said, you know, where are you away from me that I will need you? So that is the state in which the entire life finds fulfillment with Madhura Bhakti. But if you really look at our own lives, if you see, we find that in pockets in our life. You know, whenever that we are feeling that intense love for Swami, you will find that at that moment you don't need anything else. Your mind is not craving for anything else. You know, the other good example that you can think of is the state of Draupadi. You know, where she's in the midst of immense pain and she's really in the worst situation.
Being humiliated.
Right, a woman could be in. At that time, she starts calling out to Krishna and then she forgets. She kind of loses herself in that contemplation of Krishna. So even her pain at that moment is dissolved in that love. So if you really look at it that way, those moments in our life when you're so intensely thinking of Swami, those moments are fulfilled. You don't need anything else to fulfill that moment. So our journey or our endeavor, our effort should be is how many moments in our day can we fill with that kind of love where we say that at least for this moment, I don't need anything else. And I think eventually it'll become like one ceaseless moment where we are only thinking of Swami and not seeking anything else.
Beautifully said. As Adi Shankara says in the Viveka Chudamani, that there are three great blessings one can receive. Manushyatvam, Mumukshatvam, Mahapurusha Samshraya. And he almost places them in hierarchy in this order. Manushyatvam is human birth. Mumukshatvam is yearning for moksha, yearning for the ultimate. And Mahapurusha Samshraya is the grace or blessings of a Mahapurusha. Our fortune has been that we have got the first and the third, the toughest one we have got off, which is a human birth and the Samshraya or the grace of the Mahapurusha, of the avatar of the age. Because, you know, in these three, it looks like Manushyatvam, it's not in our hands. It depends on our accumulated karma. Even Mahapurusha Samshraya, to meet a Mahapurusha, again is not in our hand. Mumukshatvam or yearning is something that possibly we can develop with our effort. The good news for us is that those which are not in our hands have already been conferred to us. It's up to us to take up and develop that which is in our hands, which is yearning for the Lord. Let us pray to Swami that our yearning for Him, our craving for Him, our love for Him keeps growing stronger every passing moment. And on that note, dear listeners, we will say Sai Ram for this week's afternoon satsang. We'll end with a song, on the other side of which, as always, you'll be joined by Brother Chandu in his segment, Love to Love.
सफर में दुनिया के मंजर में अंधेरे सफर में सूरज सा बनकर तुम छा गए. हमने सोचा था जीवन ये पतझड़ सा सूखा है, साई बरखा बनकर तुम आ गए. साथ हमारा है तुमसे फूलों का जैसे शबनम से, तुम साथ रहो हर दम ओ साईं मां. हम है तुम्हारे तुम हमारे, कानों से तेरी झूमे सारा जहां, तेरे एक इशारे पर रुक जाए जमी आसमान. तेरे संसाई हम चले दूर तुझसे अब ना रहे, ख्वाहिशें हैं ये हमारी सुन लो ए हम सफर. चोटों का तुम हो मरहम, गीतों की तुम सरगम, तेरी रहमतों से हमारी सांसें हैं. हम हैं तुम्हारे तुम हमारे, जन्मों के मीत हो हरे सुबाते गुनगुनाए, साई ऐसा गीत हो. हम हैं तुम्हारे तुम.